Gregoire and Dan Beeston are smart enough to know better.
Welcome to episode 163 of Smart Enough to Know Better.
We're a podcast of science,
comedy,
and ignorance.
I'm Dan Beeston.
I'm Gregoire.
And in this episode of Smart Enough to Know Better, I teach you how to go down.
And I also teach you how they come down.
Oh, down, down, deeper and down. But before we get to that, what has happened to you this week in science?
Well, we have been called out as the science mavens that we are.
Ooh, well, good. By an esteemed college, I'm sure.
Of course. By the Raven Bond podcast. University.
I'm not familiar with the venue in question.
Well, they're above Harvard. If you can't get into Raven Bond, then you get into Harvard. It's a step down. And so, those who don't know, Raven Bond is the podcast with Natalie Behensky and Stuart Late, friends of ours. They used to be about Game of Thrones, and that stopped being a thing, and then they started talking about Doctor Who. But now they're talking about James Bond, and it's actually really good. If you like James Bond or even thinking about James Bond, go and listen to them, because it's been interesting as they go back to the old Bonds one by one and rip them to shreds. It's great.
And just take a very quick dip into, like, incredibly unwoke culture.
Oh, it's amazing.
Oh, it's wonderful.
My favorite part is listening to Natalie try and justify racism and sexism while Stuart Late just freaks out.
He's like, this is awful. It's like, well, go back in time and stop them then.
That's right. So I'm finding it fun. But they in Thunderball, James Bond and Domino don some scuba gear and then float out of shot to supposedly have some underwater nookie. And so Natalie and Stu wanted to know, can you have underwater nookie wearing scuba tanks? Can you have scuba sex? And being the scientists that we are. So what's your take on that, Dan? Can you have scuba sex, do you think?
Well, have you ever had pool sex?
Yes, I have, Dan.
Yeah. So you already know that there are all sorts of mechanics here that, like, the whole thing changes. It's not like a bedroom at all.
No. It's much wetter.
Yeah. Now, here's point number one, and it is not the most, if Queen Victoria is in the room, ask her to leave for a couple of minutes, because the thing is that when ladies are enjoying intercourse, they get slippery.
And there's lubrication, yes.
And water washes that away.
Yes.
So it actually makes it a less slippery endeavor where you want it to be slippery.
Yes, the terms microabrasions and micro tears are the two words I looked up. Micro tears and microabrasions.
Whilst that special place is getting less slippery, every other place on the body is getting more slippery. And so you kind of want to control a very specific part of the bodies and the distance apart that they are.
And the aligning of vectors.
Vectors and stuff.
Yeah, it's all about vectors. That's why I like about sex. It's about vectors.
But if you've got nothing to sort of hold on to, if you're just free floating, then there's going to be accidents. There's going to be things are going to slip out. Things are going to thrust in the wrong point and then
crush up against pelvic bones.
Yeah. Ooh. So you kind of need to, like, hold on to something.
Yeah, not a coral reef.
If you've had sex in a pool, I imagine that you've discovered that the middle of the pool is not where to do it. Up against the edge of the pool is where to do it.
In the shallow end. No one ever get to the deep end of the pool for it. Don't.
No, deep end is a problem. Like, probably, well, find your height. Mm. Because if the tallest person can stand, then there's this lovely standing uppy type thing. So these are two of the three problems that I've worked out. Third problem is if you are underwater, there's no side of the pool. So the only thing to sort of press against is the seafloor.
Yeah. Hold on to a rock or something. Yeah, coral will cut you and you put your hand in sand, like, or it could be an animal, it could be some sort of terrible eel will zip out there and have a go at you.
Like, you want to move up from micro abrasions to medium sized abrasions, then sex on the beach involves sand getting places. Sex underwater, the sand is free floating. It doesn't just drop.
Yes.
So it's getting there. It's getting where it's not supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
So sand is a problem. Okay. Don't do it. And then a weird little thing at the end is that, like, there are certain things ejected.
Ah, yes.
Insects. Yes. And you know what fish like to eat? Protein.
I think it's probably your least problem. You're not going to get swarmed by
sex. You're going to get swarmed
piranhas.
By fish. Have a look online for people breaking eggs underwater, and the fish just go nuts for the egg whites.
Oh, no. Oh, too much. Okay. All right. That's good. That went on place. But you've also, I think we're discussing snorkeling sex at this point, but now you add a scuba gear to it, which has regulators and that sort of stuff. Now you're underwater. You're probably 10 meters underwater, so the pressures are different. You go down too far, the hydraulic pressure may be too hard for the person with the penis to, like, there may be too much pressure holding it in position to actually get blood inside it. If you go too deep, I have a look at how many atmospheres. The atmospheric pressure would be a problem, because in the end you'd be
cold.
Cold. You want it to be about 20 degrees. I looked at about, they said about 20 degrees, no lower than 20 degrees, because your body can, you know, there's shrinkage. But also, if you're having fun fumbly times and you knock out your regulator, you could literally drown. I mean, you could just drown. And you could knock out the pipes on the back. They even say that it's possible that you may get an embolism, because it's high-pressure air. You're not breathing in atmospheric air. It's higher pressure air, and that can lead to problems with the brain. And let's face it, if you're doing it right, there's a lot of intake of air going on. Sorry, that was me. But, and so that can lead to problems as well. So the sheer fact that you're having sex in a scuba tank means that you're probably not wondering about the scuba tank, and therefore you could very easily die. So scuba sex is difficult as well.
And also, hyperventilation is a danger underwater.
Yep.
Because your breathing is different, and so James Bond has nothing to worry about with all those. Like, James Bond is James Bond. I'm sure that he can get an erection in sub-zero temperatures at, like, 20 meters deep. Like, he's got, as they mention on the podcast, he has a magical penis.
Yes.
But Domino...
You die another day, I think he actually is in a gold... He is in an ice palace. Does he have sex in the ice palace? I can't remember. He probably does. We'll have to wait for the podcast to come out.
Yeah. Domino's, like, in all sorts of trouble.
Mm.
She's going to hyperventilate... Like, well, and she's going to forget.
And then suddenly die dead. You know.
And the thing is, people know go up, like the hand signals go up, and like the couple of hand signals. But what are the hand signals for, like, faster, deeper, put it there?
I'm being attacked by fish.
I'm not ready yet. A fish has gotten hold of my magic penis.
Yeah, that's right. It's a whole thing. So, yes, mechanically you can have sex underwater. Down to a certain depth, it gets very difficult. Temperature-wise, why would you want to? I guess to prove you could.
Novelty. People, novelty can, but you can do it, but do it once and then you'll realize why you shouldn't.
We sound like middle-aged men, don't we?
Like, start in a pool, I reckon.
Yeah, work your way down.
Start at the shallow end, work your way down. Just like all relationships.
So how's your week in science been, Dan?
I've been eating apples more than usual. It occurred to me that there's a phrase, one bad apple can spoil the whole batch. And that means that everyone can be awesome, but then one jerk can come in and he'll, like, poison everyone against each other. But what happens when you get a real rotten apple and stick it in a barrel full of apples that are fine? Like, does that ruin the whole batch? Or is that just a nonsense saying? Apples, when they ripen, they release a gas called ethylene. The gas causes ripening in other fruit as well. You shouldn't store apples next to bananas, because the bananas ripen fast and go off fast. Keep all your bananas apart and they won't sort of cause each other to ripen too quickly.
Yeah.
And if you've got an avocado that's too firm, stick it in a paper bag with an apple and it'll go soft faster. And this accounts for peaches and melons and tomatoes and kiwi fruit and a wealth of other fruit. And I was trying to find why this would evolve, and I couldn't find anything. But I do have a theory. Is anything occurring to you?
A fruit is a way of a plant to attract an animal. And the animal comes over and goes, ooh, that looks like a tasty fruit, eats it, and then poops out the seed somewhere else. So it takes it away. So it's a way of getting a very large animal, or an animal large enough to eat your fruit, to spread your children far and wide, so they don't just fall. So the apple does fall further from the tree.
Yeah. It's like the Apple's version of having sex underwater. In that it's just on a procreation level.
Oh, I see.
The metaphor does not extend very far.
I was about to say, it's just like your penis at 5 atmospheres.
It extends not very far.
That's right. It's a domino effect. No?
Although you did find the pun for the end of the episode that they were asking about.
Oh, good. Yes. Yes. When they fly away, they can have that one. That'll make sense to the listeners when they listen to the podcast. It's getting very, very meta now. All right. So I assume that you want all your fruit to ripen at the same time if you want other bits of fruit, because you don't want to be a horrible, nasty, green and sour fruit when everyone else is all lovely and tasty, because then your babies won't get passed all over the world. So you want, when they start ripening, like, oh, we're all going to ripen at the same time, so the animals will eat us all and deliver it all out there. So you're just trying to, you're trying to attract animals first to you. That's my guess.
I had a slightly different viewpoint of it.
Cool, yeah.
Because I figured that, I mean, apple trees aren't necessarily going to be next to each other. So if you're it's the same thing. If you're an apple tree, you want your animals to spread your seed. You grow a bunch of apples and they ripen and fall off and animals eat the flesh and they carry the seed. Now, if the tree only has one apple ready at a time, then one animal can eat that fruit and then hang around and have another fruit the next day and another fruit the next day. But that animal will probably keep all of their various habits and disperse the seed in the same area each day.
Okay.
Whereas if everything is ready at the same time, if all the apples are ripened at the same time, then many animals will come to the tree, eat the fruit 1 or 2 days, and then scatter them all over the place.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, that makes sense.
It's possible, more beneficial to have like a Mardi Gras of apples rather than a constant trickle.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. So I was thinking more amongst other fruit, but you're just talking about one apple tree alone. Yeah,
that makes sense. Animals have to eat all the time. So if all the animals drop their fruit at the same day, the animal can only have a couple of them. But then it comes back a week later and there's more apples. You kind of want to drop all of yours at the same time, but away from all the other ones, maybe.
Talking about animals eating things,
we've done a couple of times already.
I was reading about pets eating their owners.
Nice.
Let's say you live in a flat and you've got a cat and a dog in the flat and you live alone and you die. And then how long before your pets eat you? And dogs, it seems, hold off. Dogs will hold off for a while, but they will eat you. But they're more emotionally attached. Whatever the reason is, they don't want to go for you, but they will in the end eat you. Cats will eat you quite quickly and they go for softer areas. So genitals and faces, they like faces, and your hands, supposedly, like biting into the fleshy bits of the hand. Why I'm mentioning this,
cats start before you die. Let's admit that.
Let's face it, you're weak. That's why everyone's like, oh, I got woken up by Tiddles this morning staring at me. And they're like, no, they're trying to work out how to eat you and whether they can start before your large monkey hands get around their throat. They're working it out. Like, they're clever. They're learning. So that wasn't what I was going to tell you about. The rabbit hole I went down, so it led on to different bodies and animals eating it. Remember, we talked to Dr. Caitlin Syme about this, and that was her job, the taphonomy.
Oh, yes.
About dinosaur taphonomy, but this is just in modern day animal taphonomy. So I was interested in all that sort of stuff. And they talk about body farms. You know, like in the FBI, they take up a human body and they put it in a trunk to see how it decomposes, or put it out, they find someone in the wild, they can say, that person's... These bugs mean this person is, you know, all the rest. What they discovered at this body farm was there was a cat. And they said, I thought it was a feral cat. And it turned out not to be a feral cat. It would come over the fence and come in. It had a collar on. And it would eat one of the bodies. But would only eat that body. It would come. And over many, many, many days, over 10 days, it only supped on the flesh of that person. And though there were other bodies that it could smell. So they're trying to work out why. They don't know why. But they went, oh, it's a feral cat. No, not a feral cat. That was someone's lovely home moggy. So you leave it. But 2 points. They will eat you. And leave your cat at home. Don't let it go out because it could be going out at night, going into a body farm and devouring someone and coming home and being all, oh, I'm sweet Tiddles. Give me bickies.
Yeah, I've just been out eating like 200 mammals a week. I haven't eaten certainly none that look like you. Ah, look. my butter couldn't melt in my mouth.
But their flesh could because it was really rotten. I mean, I just love that. And I don't know why. Even when the body was a bit, you go, it's got a bit manky. The cat was still like, oh, there are still parts. Of this, but for some reason, that body, they don't know why. And you go, cats, what are they about?
Maybe all the other bodies actually fed them, but this guy had hands that he could bite those. He could bite the hand that hadn't fed him.
I guess so. That was tortured. That was very tortured. Just like the man after his death.
It would have been a lot. It would have been a lot slicker if I hadn't just fallen over every second word. You and I watched Jurassic Park a couple of weeks ago.
We did.
Such
yes.
a good film. One of my favorite films. It's
for
so
secret
good.
Project reasons, can't mention it.
Well, I was just going to say that we watched it. You're the one mentioning secret project reasons.
Oh, fair enough. Damn it, I'm so bad at this.
And also, the outcome was, yeah, no secret project.
Maybe. Or is there? See what I did there?
You're just going to make people upset and email us and go, hey, you can let me in on the secret project.
Well, they can if they pay enough money to our Patreon.
That's not how that works. Don't add more work for me.
We can add another tier of secret knowledge here.
All right, we're off track.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, but the outcome of this is that now I want to see proper dinosaurs. Mm. No more movies, no more animatronics. I want to see the proper thing.
Right. Dan, I hate to break it to you. They died out. Well, the non-avian ones died out 65 million years ago.
Yeah, I know. Okay. And you've misparked the Pimp My Time machine. We haven't seen it in months.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
Somewhere in time, which is an ironic thing, yeah.
It's up on blocks.
Time blocks!
I think
we went to a bad time neighborhood. They took out time wheels.
I think it's the alternator. Yeah, it doesn't alternate multiverses anymore.
No, it's very weird. Strange.
Okay, so the second best way to see dinosaurs, of course,
birds.
It's time for a journey to the center of the earth. Okay.
What?
Rock is hard and magma is hot.
Good.
Okay. The earth's crust is like the skin of the apple of destruction.
Right.
It's very thin. It makes up just 0.1% of the Earth's mass. In some places, it's very thick, 80 kilometers.
Mm-hmm.
The furthest humans have drilled down so far is 12 kilometers. The Kola Superdeep Borehole is a Russian science project where we attempted to drill down as far as we could. We made it.
Pop the Earth like a balloon.
Since it all squishes out, it's all helium inside. And in our last dying breath, we're like, I have lived forever.
I am the Cup Death Destroyer of Worlds!
Okay, we made it 12,262 metres, a third of the way through the Baltic crust. The width of the hole was slightly wider than the span of a human hand. There are longer holes drilled, but they started higher from sea level. So that one's the deepest one. It costs a lot of money. The price rises exponentially as you get deeper. You can't just get a big metal drill and go at it. Imagine.
Why can't we get all the people who are unemployed and just give them a shovel and go for it. Dig. There you go.
Because they could dig a really wide hole, but they couldn't dig a really deep hole.
Why not?
Because the width of the shovel and the amount of, like, you can't dig underneath. You can't get 100 people to dig underneath the other person's shovel.
No. You serialize them. So you make an inverted pyramid. And then you walk down the edge of the pyramid and you get one shovel load and you walk back out and then you walk and your next person shovels that and away you go. Simple.
An inverted pyramid.
Yeah.
Ah, you've got...
Like a mine. Like they have mines. In front of say here. Just dig into the earth. Yeah. Rip the crust open.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you've solved one of the problems.
Ooh, look at me.
Ooh.
I think I live in Western Australia, which is a land of mines.
Oh, already. Yes.
We love digging things here. Yeah, go on, please.
Okay. Imagine you had some sort of shaft and it was a meter and a half long.
Oh, well, I don't have to imagine.
Okay. It's going to be stiff and hard.
Right.
But a 100 meters shaft is going to have some wobble in the center.
true.
You need something really stiff, so make it thicker. Give it more girth.
This is very sexy.
Except that the hanging weight of the drill increases as the girth increases, making it more likely to break. So add more girth, but that adds weight, and that makes it more likely to break. So add more girth, and you could see the problem.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is the same reason, by the way, that elevators have difficulty being built into very tall buildings.
Ooh.
Very similar problem, because the cables have to support their own weight. And as they get, the higher you go, the thicker your cable has to go, which means there's more weight for your therefore your cable has to get thicker. And in the end, you've got these massive cables. It's a very similar issue, but vertical instead of de-vertical. De-vertical?
De-vertical.
De-vertical.
Paravertical.
Re-vertical. There we go. Reverse vertical.
So just like the elevator shaft, you need a thin drill at the end and then a thicker shaft above that and a thicker one above that and a thicker one above that. Like a space elevator, but upside down.
Like an inverted pyramid.
So your drill is long and hard and penetrates deep into the Earth's mound. Make sure you get that bush out of the way. You want this mound clear. Bush turned up later in Earth's lifespan, and we want this mound to look like the mound of a teenage Earth. So the drill thrusts into the mound, but the deeper it gets, the warmer it gets, Greg. We think of going underground as being cold, but that's only as we get away from the sun's warmth. The deeper we go, the warmer it is, the softer the metal we used becomes. It doesn't melt, but its effectiveness as a cutting tool reduces. So at some point, you need to change the metal you're using. You need stronger and stronger metal. But the stronger a metal is, the more brittle it becomes. Also, the more available it is to chemical attack. And there are all sorts of horrible chemicals underground. That's where horrible chemicals come from, Greg. That's where we get them all from.
You talk about the heat increase, which I find really interesting. It can get really hot really quickly. So the deepest mines that humans can have made, I believe, are in South Africa, and the gold mines, and they're about 3 kilometers in that ballpark. We can walk with Shami on that, but it's about 3 kilometers, maybe even close to 4 in that ballpark, deep. And the humans can get in those mines to dig out gold. So it's not the same as the ball. These are mines, you know, all over the place. And they can get like between 40 and 50 degrees Celsius, which is super hot. And that's from just the heat in the earth. Not because trapping, I mean, I guess you are trapping the heat there as well from the humans or the machines, but that's how quickly. So if you go down 18 kilometers, it's going to be ludicrously hot down there, I assume.
Yeah. But yes, there's also these terrible chemicals. The worst one is hydrogen sulfide gas.
Ah, yes. Not fun.
Okay. This gas leaves one of its hydrogen molecules on the metal of the drill. And what remains is a highly corrosive acid. So meanwhile, the metal has an extra hydrogen molecule on it. It's carbon, so it creates hydrocarbons. This creates methane molecules inside the metal. Those molecules are big, so they put forces into the metal that aren't supposed to be there, causing extreme embrittlement. So this gas hits the metal, the gas becomes a terrible acid and metal that is puffed up and explosive.
Brittle and explosive. Great.
Maybe we could use an advanced nickel base alloy. That's going to work, but the cost is absurd.
And no one likes nickel base. It's not popular. No? Yes?
I like your pants 12 Ks underground.
Good.
I like when your body can't be found.
Oh, wow. Once again,
I can love it when I can't hear the sound of you yelling, please. Sorry.
No. What? Oh, God. This whole thing is weird.
You figured me out.
Oh.
Okay. So.
I'm sad now.
For many deep holes, they pump mud down the pipe, down the drill, down the shaft. The mud pushes the drill bits and spins them. So that's what drives it. It's not like
it's hydraulic. Sort of.
It's hydraulics using mud. Yeah. The mud pushes the drill bit, and then it returns up the well, bringing
A bill drip. Sorry. Good old bill drip.
Bill drip.
Poor bill drip.
Okay.
He means well.
The mud pushes the drill bit, and then it returns up the sides of the well, bringing all of the ground up rock with it. Because when you're drilling, like, it doesn't just evaporate the rock. You've got to get those scraps of rock out. So the mud pulls it back up to the surface. But, of course, the deeper you get, the more mud you're trying to lift. So the more pressure you've got to force down in order to force the mud back up.
In the end, everything breaks. I wonder why you don't drill down. I guess you've got to get down there. I was about to say, you drill down and then you say, okay, we're a kilometer down now. Make a staging area, build a cavern, and then you start drilling from that cavern and you drill down from that point. That's your new ground level and you go from there. And every kilometer, you make another and then you go down that point. And
if you say you want to dig out a little sort of node at the bottom of the well.
Yeah, like, and you have to get someone down there. That's the hard part. You have to make a human level hole.
That's a
big hole, yeah.
Even
like a supermodel would be a very big hole.
The mud is under pressure. Because if you just used sea level pressure mud, underneath all that rock, there's actually it's much denser and there's all that force of ground coming down. And so you've got to increase the pressure of the mud that goes down the pipe so that the sides of the wall don't crush in on it.
It
balances the pressure.
And if you don't, you must really have to know the geology, because if you say, oh, we're digging through granite, you're like, well, that's bad, but okay, fine, it won't collapse. If you go into some sort of shaley sort of area or something, you know, mud area, it may collapse. The whole thing, the sides just may wilt. Like, yeah, if you don't know what you're drilling into, you're going to drill into something stupid and wreck your drill or bog your drill.
Yes, well, if your mud is too dense, it can fracture the sides of the cavity, or you hit something like shale and it sort of spreads, it breaks in, and then you lose pressure and then the pressures don't match and you risk like this catastrophic blowback event.
Oh, good.
That's the last thing you want when penetrating your mound with your hard shaft is a catastrophic blowback, Greg.
Yeah, that's what I'm worried about. I'm more worried about being called by the police, to be honest, at this point. That's fine. Losing my blue card. I'm working with children's check. That's all I'm saying. No.
All right. Enough of this seediness. Let's get back in the hole. So you need to cement a metal wall into place on the edge of the hole to protect you from this pressurized mud blowing out the side.
Goodness
me. So you dig a hole for 100 meters, you case it off, you up your mud density, then you use a slightly smaller drill bit for the next bit. Repeat every 100 meters for 12 kilometers.
That drill must be tiny at that point, like a nano drill.
Or you start with a big one. Like, you know how far you want to go and you start bigger.
It starts off being 400 meters wide and by the end.
It's not like the end is like a dentist's drill. Because you still need your concrete and steel to be big.
Right.
So that's and strong.
Yeah.
All right, so 12K is a long way. Let's find somewhere on Earth where the crust is thinner. Okay. Gregoire, we are off to beautiful Lake Baikal in Siberia.
I've been there.
Have you?
Yeah.
You jumped on the train and...
I went across to Siberia, went on the went to Irkutsk nearby. I've swum in that lake. It was very cold. There were fat seals there, little round seals that no one knows how they got there. There are seals that live in the lake, which is really weird.
Good God. I mean, you just said no one knows how they get there, but I can't stop myself from saying, how the hell did they get there?
And it's a freshwater lake, which is the weird thing. It's not a saltwater lake. It's not connected to land for a very long time, but it's built into a fissure, so it's ripping apart.
It's the oldest lake on the planet, Greg.
And it holds a quarter of the world's water, I think.
Yeah.
So, well, freshwater, I should
22%.
Say. 22%. There you go. Yeah. So it's freaking cold. That's all I have to say. I went there in like spring, like it wasn't winter time. Duh, Siberia, man. Siberia, it's a thing.
Yeah, they should use it as a punishment.
They really should. They should think that through. But it's a lovely place, very beautiful. But yes, and it's like a fissure, isn't it? It's like a
rift valley.
A rift valley,
meaning that the continental plates separated and a chasm appeared.
Nice.
The lake is the oldest lake in the world. It's the deepest lake in the world. It is the clearest lake in the world, and it contains 22% of all the fresh water in the world. It contains more water than all of the Great Lakes combined.
Wow. In America? Not just any Great Lake, you know.
Yeah, no, the capital G, capital L.
not just lakes you really like. That's a Great Lake.
It's all right.
It's all right. How dare you?
It's a bit damp.
well known for being a bit dad. Not good for sexy times.
No, no, James Bond.
No, no.
No dominoes there. No. Okay, so the crust at this point got thinner and thinner, and Mother Earth eased back her plates to reveal her moist, deep chasm. Oh, this God. Makes it more inviting for us, Gregoire.
Oh, God.
Okay, the thickness of the crust here is rumoured to be less than 2 kilometres, though this yeah. is contentious.
Yeah.
It is somewhere between 1.7 kilometres and 37 kilometres thick.
I was about to say, because it's continental crust, and continental crust is thicker than oceanic crust, as far as I'm aware. And so I'm intrigued that Lake Baikal is so deep that it could just be peaking up. That's interesting to me. That's, yeah, fantastic.
Yeah. So we could start drilling there, although it does obviously start 1.5 km underwater, which could be a bit tricky for our drill. But that's sure. all right. You can drill underwater.
Yeah.
People have been doing it for years.
Yeah. Deeper than 1.5 km, too.
Okay. There's oil. Possibly 7 kilometres of silt to get through. But we're not sure. Not sure. There's a lot of misinformation out there.
Yeah. And the seals aren't talking.
No, their lips are seal.
Their lips. Oh. That's right. Bye.
Thank you. Okay. Every kilometre that we descend, the temperature goes up 35 degrees Celsius.
Uh-huh.
Now, Americans must be going out of their minds at this point.
Yes.
Because, gosh, I've used the word kilometres a lot. And now it's Celsius. And you know what? Now it's your turn to get the calculator out, clever clogs.
It's easy. The mile is like 1.6 kilometres. You can work it out from there. You'll be fine.
You'll be fine. So as we dig down, it's getting hotter and hotter, but why, Gregoire?
I'm going to say that it's two things, and two things only, is the leftover heat from the creation of the planet Earth, because yep. hot and you know, it takes time to cool down, and radiating heat is actually hard. There's nothing in space to convect or conduct the heat away, so you can only radiate it out as infrared. So that takes time. That takes longer than obviously billions of years, but mm-hmm. also radioactive elements in the crust. I'm really into how planets formed, and that's an area I wrote a little paper on that years ago.
Good, yes. good. Well, that's kind of what I expected you to say, because I love writing you into traps. So Dr. Carl tweeted, and he agrees with you, Greg, that it was due to radioactive decay. And I thought, that's not right. He's forgotten about tidal heating.
Oh, there is that. Oh, yeah.
Now, the Earth started out super hot, and mm-hmm. only the surfaces cooled.
Mm-hmm.
Residual heat from this accounts for only 10% of the heat inside the planet. There's gravitational heat. The densest parts of the planet, the iron, slowly make their way towards the core.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's very slow, but the heavier stuff goes down the bottom and the lighter stuff sits on top.
That's why there's an iron, big iron core.
All the helium mucking around at the top of the atmosphere.
In the exosphere, which we'll talk about later.
Oh, no, not back into the not into the atmosphere again.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, that was a maelstrom. Okay. But, yes, as the heavier things go down and the lighter things come up, the friction of that heats things up.
Mm.
Now, there's also latent heat. Mm-hmm. The core is slowly turning to solid metal from liquid metal.
Yes.
Because it's so condensed. As it does so, the solid metal expands slightly,
mm-hmm.
causing more friction heat to be formed. So there's a lot of, like, it's a very economic core.
Yeah. And thank goodness, because otherwise we wouldn't have a magnetic field. We wouldn't have the liquidy bits and the solidy bits all moving around each other. We think that creates a magnetic field. We think.
Yeah.
We're not sure, but we think.
Okay. There is also tidal heating. When a body acts upon the Earth, like the sun or the moon, it squishes the form. The oceans and everything else gets pulled by gravitational forces, and the whole thing kind of wobbles. Like a paperclip being bent back and forth, it heats things up.
Mm-hmm.
Mars's moon Io has 400 volcanoes fueled by this process as it passes between Jupiter and
Jupiter's moon, Io, not Mars's moon, Io.
Oh, yeah. Look, I'm an idiot because I put Jupiter there. No, Mars's moon Io is a long way away from Jupiter and all of its moons. Oh, geez.
Phobos and Deimos are Mars's moons.
Yeah.
Io is one of the
galaxies. I know that from Doom. Okay, Jupiter's moon Io has 400 volcanoes fueled by this process as it passes between Jupiter and all of Jupiter's moons.
Mm.
On Earth,
it gets squashed a lot. It's really squishy.
Very squished.
Mm.
Okay. On Earth, this effect accounts for very little heating.
Mm.
Our moon, Colin, mm-hmm. is simply too far away to have a measurable effect. That wasn't always the case, and tidal heating from the moon could have added to the system. But the system at the time was mostly on fire at the at that point, yes. So it was all much of a muchness.
Yeah, the Hadean era, yeah. As in Hades, as in it was all molten horror.
Yeah. So
and then Theia turned up and crashed into us and blew the crust off and created the buttons before Colin, and then it's the whole thing. It's the whole thing.
Whole thing. God, I'm writing a letter.
I don't.
So Gregoire, what is doing most of the heating? Radioactivity. Dr. Carl was right, and so were you.
Hooray!
God damn it. Okay, yep. So decaying radioactive isotopes in the mantle account for the majority of heat from the center of the Earth. Potassium-40, uranium-238 and 235, and thorium-232. But why is the top of the mantle still so hot? It's got boiling magma there.
Mm.
Well, the inside of the planet works like a big convection oven. The hot elements at the bottom move upwards and the cooler stuff sinks down closer to the core. And the whole thing is this big swirly mess that's constantly bringing the core-style heat to nearer the surface. So quite frankly, it's amazing that the dinosaurs can survive at all.
That's I remember we were talking about dinosaurs at one point. We had a lovely conversation about geology. So what are the dinosaurs have to do with this?
Because all the stories say you just journey, you tunnel into the center of the world, and then there's this amazing landscape of dinosaurs.
You didn't really explain that at the start. I was very confused.
I didn't think I needed to.
I see.
We're journeying to the center of the Earth, Greg.
Right. Got it. I'm sorry. But I guess I'm assuming that the dinosaurs aren't there because they've all been killed by the Nazis.
They wouldn't do that, would they?
Well, they're Nazis. Of course, that's what they do.
Are dinosaurs Jewish?
So I received an email from one of our listeners, Al. Hello, Al. And Al wanted to ask a question about satellites being put into orbit. And sometimes you hear about them crashing to Earth and sometimes you don't. And Skylab in the 1970s came crashing to Earth again. And somewhere over at Western Australia, there's pieces of it near Esperance, but then it crashed into the Pacific Ocean.
That was the plan, though, wasn't it?
Yes, but they didn't really plan on where it was going to come down. No one wanted it to crash into Australia. Like, they didn't want bits of it to land on Australia. They wanted to crash it into the Pacific Ocean, but they weren't too sure for a while. It was like, hey, watch out, Perth. You may be hit by a massive satellite.
I remember that day.
Do you? You must be very young.
Maybe there was another one that was risking hitting Australia.
There has been numbers of them. Yes, that's right. Yes. So you would have been very young. It was 1979?
So they put them up there and were like, oh, we'll work out how to get it down later.
I don't think they, once again, that's good. I'm not 100%, but they had an idea and it didn't kind of pay off, I think is what the it's the main thing to take away from this.
Do they have a plan for the ISS?
We'll talk about that later on. We'll get to that. So to answer the question that Al wanted to ask is, what he said was, I always thought that active satellites need constant boosting and adjusting to remain in a correct orbit and eventually run out of fuel and tumble back through the atmosphere and burn up. How is it that we have so much dead stuff zooming around the Earth and not dropping back to the Earth? And why is the requirement not being put in place for launches to have tiny boosts back into the atmosphere to burn up? So he's saying, well, how come there are some satellites are up there and some satellites fall back down? And why don't we actually bring them back? Like, why don't we say bring them back down? Like, why don't we put rockets on them and return them to Earth? So I looked into this.
Space parachutes.
Look, there's a lot of – we'll get onto that. Think space harpoons more so than parachutes. Nets and harpoons, like whalers of old.
Oh, man, I want to be a space whaler.
Your own Moby Dick. It all depends what you call a satellite, because satellites can be in lots of different orbits. So you talked before about the International Space Station.
That's a white satellite, a huge white satellite, but I've never been able to catch it.
You just change the size of the International Space Station, stabbing at it. The last we've ever seen. Well, every 90 minutes, you.
It Moby Colin.
So satellites are at different orbits. If you have a low Earth orbit satellite, like the International Space Station is at low Earth orbit, and low Earth orbit is about 400. Well, it's at 400. At the International Space Station, is about 400 kilometers up, which is, seems like a long way away. Because we call the edge of space officially the Kármán line. It's 100 kilometers up. So you go, well, it's four times the edge of space. So it's well and truly in space at this point.
Yeah, but you could drive there in like half a day.
If you
had a road that went straight up.
And you could, well, you, in 4 hours, exactly right. It wouldn't be that long at all. We sort of think of it as a long way away, but you can see it from the Earth. You can get a little app and you can see it going overhead. It's kind of a dot. You can do it pretty easily. It goes around the Earth about 11 times, if I remember correctly. So once every 90 minutes or so, it goes around the Earth. So it's in a fast orbit. And so these low Earth orbit satellites are quite close to the Earth, and they're zooming around, zooming around, zooming around.
Ripping by.
Moving.
Otherwise, they fall down.
They do, because what they're doing, as they fall down, they're also moving sideways at ridiculous speeds, and they go around the Earth. They keep falling, but the Earth is curving away, and that's an orbit. That's technically what an orbit is. So the International Space Station is moving at 7.6 kilometers a second. There you go. So it's zooming along. It needs to go at nearly 8 kilometers a second, so it falls past the edge of the planet and keeps going around and around and around. That is
mind-bending.
That's what it's doing. Isn't it weird? That's like it's still falling down. There's still gravity pulling it down, but as it falls down, it's moving so fast sideways.
Yeah. As it falls down, the Earth underneath it drops at the away. Same rate.
Yes.
Oh, God. It's just...
Yes. It's mind-blowing. It's just crazy. And that's what an orbit is. Now, you may think to yourself, well, that's great. That's we said 400 kilometers, four times higher than the Kármán line, the official edge of space. If you can get up to the Kármán line in your own spaceship, then you are officially an astronaut. So that's what they consider it. But the Kármán line, 100 kilometers up, is still well and truly in a part of the atmosphere called the thermosphere. And the thermosphere goes from about 80 kilometers to up to about 1,000 kilometers, roughly. And so there's still atmosphere there. It's very thin. It's about one. It's mainly
very energetic helium molecules.
It's not helium at this point. It can be like oxygen or ozone. It can travel a kilometer before it runs into another molecule.
Yeah.
So they're rarefied, these molecules between them. But it's still there, and if you're traveling at 7.6 kilometers a second, then you could be running into
dozens of them.
Every second you're running into, and you're going to go, that's not a lot, but it's continuous and forever. There is some slight drag. You are running through a very thin atmosphere if you're in low Earth orbit, and that will drag you down. And so once a year,
it won't so much drag you down as it'll run into you and slow you down, your forward momentum down.
Yes,
which
that's
means
true.
That the ground is not falling away fast enough.
You're technically correct, the best sort of correct.
Bam!
So you slow down, your speed, your orbital velocity is lower, and when you get a lower orbital velocity, what's weird is this, when you slow down in an orbit, you drop down, and when you speed up in an orbit, you go up.
Well, you don't. When you slow down, you don't go down. You're always going down.
When you get closer to the Earth.
But when you slow down, the Earth stops dropping
running away from
as
yes.
much. And if you're well, going yes. faster, the yep. Earth is actually dropping away faster.
Yes,
but you're not. You're not dropping. You're constantly dropping.
Yes, but you end up in a higher orbit if you speed up, and you're in a lower orbit if you slow down. It's a way of people think that if you're in space, how would you go towards planet Earth? Well, you try and push, you'd fire a thruster upwards to push you down, but you wouldn't need to. You actually fire it in your direction of motion to slow you down to go back to the Earth. You have to kind of think in a different way.
Yeah, because you want to be going fairly slow when you hit some of that thicker atmosphere.
Well, yes, very much so. We can definitely get to that part. The International Space Station once a year needs to be boosted back up, at least about once a year, and boosted. It can drop down quite a few kilometers.
So is it just Houston gets on the radio and is like, you're doing a great job there, champ. Doing a great job. keep it up.
And there's things like electromagnetic drag, which I'd never thought of before. There have been satellites that have been put into orbit trailing long lines behind them, and they electrify those lines, and those lines then...
Wait, literal lines? Like cables?
Cables, yes. And then they electrify them and give them energy.
Like which squids. Like squids.
Space squids. And you can create a Lorentz force on it, which pushes against the magnetic field of the Earth, and then it can actually push itself further into a higher orbit. It's pushing against the magnetic field.
Turning into a big magnet, kind of.
Yes, repelling itself. Exactly, yes. A Lorentz force is similar, yeah. So it pushes itself away. Now, the problem with that is when you don't power it, it creates drag, electromagnetic drag, which will pull it back down again because it's generating, because a motor is a generator in reverse. It works in the reverse.
Yeah.
That's a different thing. So you say, well, that's pretty close, but what about things that are super, super high? So to answer this question, if you're close to the Earth, you're going to fall out of the sky one day. And back in the day, they never worked out. They just went, oh, they'll fall out, and we'll work out when they're going to fall out. Now countries and companies like SpaceX have to sign treaties saying at the end of the life of this device, it will come back to Earth. We will give it a kick, and we will bring it back into the Earth so it crashes into the ocean somewhere. Normally, there's a big part of the Pacific that's very far away from everywhere else that it crash everything into because there's not going to be anyone there.
And as it goes into, you
have to look it up. It's in pretty much the center of the Pacific, as you sort of understand it. It has a name too, which
is it like 200K across, or is it like massive?
I guess you just say you'd aim it at a point, and if it's a little bit off, it doesn't really matter because it's, you know, who cares? It's the Pacific Ocean. It's the biggest ocean we have, the South Pacific. As far as I'm aware, it's between Australia and South America. That's where they crash them into. It's the widest point because at the top in the North Pacific, it sort of starts getting, you know, Japan and North America. And
look at it down there. Oh, gosh. It's so between New Zealand and Chile.
Oh, there you go. Okay. Yep. Yeah.
It's called the Spacecraft Cemetery.
Nice. That's a perfect name for it. So we have these low Earth orbits and things come out of the sky. They will come out. Of course, as they get lower and lower and lower, the drag increases, which means they get lower and lower and lower, and the drag increases, and they get lower and lower and lower, and the drag increases. In the end, the friction is too much and they burn up and they fall apart. And that's okay if they're made of stuff that falls apart, but sometimes they're made of things which are meant not to fall apart, like nuclear reactors. Not that we do that anymore, thank goodness, but you don't want to put like a reactor in space and then drop it on someone and kill them, or have radioactive material go all over the place. So we have to destroy them. Sometimes we blow them up, or that's the Americans have been practicing with firing missiles up at satellites to destroy them. They say to get rid of debris, but I think it's more to destroy future spy satellites. But that's conspiracy. We don't know. Now, you can go much higher than that, though. You think, well, that's great.
I would have thought that blowing up a nuclear reactor would be the last thing you would want to do.
If you want, I guess you'd want to destroy the material. You want to render it so there's not much of it around. You want to melt it, get rid of it that way.
Oh, so it disperses. So a little tiny. So, like, if it hits the atmosphere and goes shh and becomes radioactive dust,
it'll burn up.
Spreads out. I mean, it'd still be radioactive if it burns.
Yes, but I guess it's the whole if you want to get rid of that sort of stuff, then you want to there's a lot of horrible things coming from space all the time. So I guess a little bit more. You don't want a big chunk of it landing somewhere.
No,
so
you just
want to kind of make it small. But these are very close orbits, low Earth orbits. So there are much higher ones, much more useful ones, geostationary orbits. So when you have like a satellite sitting over Australia, that's our Telstra satellites. They don't want to be whizzing around the Earth all the time.
They don't go around the Earth once every hour and a half.
No, they go every 24 hours.
About 24 hours?
Roughly, yeah. And there are super synchronous orbits.
Exactly. 23 hours, 58 minutes or something.
We want to make it as much as possible. And they're really high. So you're talking about 35,700 kilometers. So
35,000. Okay, wow, that's a lot farther than 400.
That's much, much further than 400. So these things are way out there, like super, 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 super out there. And when they're finished with their lives, they are well out of they're now sitting basically we wouldn't call it the atmosphere at all. They're past the exosphere. So we had the thermosphere before, and then the exosphere goes up to about 10,000 kilometers. And then beyond that, where we are now, so we're talking 35,700 kilometers up. That's well out of our atmosphere. And these things will stay, unless they're perturbed, will stay in those orbits for a very, very, very long time. Then it costs a lot of energy to bring them back. So if you've got to bring them back to Earth, it's not just a matter of slowing them down. Well, you want to slow them down to bring them down and keep lowering the orbit. But The problem with that is it takes a lot of energy to bring them down. So they don't a lot of time want to bring them back down. They want to park them in what's called a graveyard orbit. So they actually take them slightly higher. So they give, instead of being 35,700, they go to about 36,000 kilometers, and that's a graveyard. They park them up even higher. So they park them out there and say, okay, that's where it's going to stay until one day we're going to go get them. It takes much less energy to boost them slightly higher than it does to bring them back home.
But wouldn't they then just leave the orbit? Wouldn't they just go off?
Oh, because I see what you're saying. Because you keep moving until a force acts on you. But a force is acting on you. You have gravity that's still pulling on you. It's not running away from the Earth forever. So you could blast away from the Earth and get away from the Earth entirely, which I think it's 11 kilometers a second to get away entirely. But if you're talking about a small increase of delta V, the velocity of the craft, it will move further away from the Earth and then be going around the Earth in that new higher orbit. And that's called a graveyard orbit. And they leave them up there.
But they're not hitting any atmosphere at all, so they're not slowing down anywhere as fast as the...
Okay. No, they'll be up there for millions of years. But they are saying nowadays that they want to... If low Earth orbit, you've got to bring them back to Earth, you've got to crash them. Or if they're up there, they're talking about maybe building into the cost of the satellite to pay someone to go up there with this new technology, either a harpoon. So you fire a harpoon into it and you drag it home, or you put a big net over it and then drag it home as well. But that's in the future. We're only starting that sort of idea now, because low Earth orbit's becoming super, super, super busy. And if there's cascade effects, things smashing and breaking, and we track all these bits of debris to make sure it doesn't hit anyone. And sometimes the International Space Station has to be boosted up and basically boosted away out of the path of something else.
Imagine having to track that stuff. Do they? Can they actually see it? They radar.
And they track down to the things the size of bolts. So, and there are tens of thousands of these things, and they're tracking them with radar to make out, because they know the orbit. Unless the orbits change, which they're not going to, unless they run into something, which is what they're tracking them to find out that's going on. So it's getting very dangerous. Now, you kind of think, but all these geostationary satellites, that's dangerous. But think of the sphere, it's pi r squared to work out.
Yeah, lots of space out there.
There's lots of space.
That's where it gets the name from.
That's right. So by increasing the radius by 200 kilometers for a graveyard orbit, if pi r squared, it starts getting even huge, gets squared. So that extra 200, it starts getting, 200 squared. It's huge. So it's a bigger area once again for the outer sphere. So I found it really interesting that, yes, if it's close, it's going to fall back in and we try and bring it back in. If it's far away, we park them out and we'll just let the future worry about our trash later.
And you wouldn't, and they wouldn't have to go as fast up there because the Earth's gravity is diminished.
Yes,
another force that's going to be acting on it, or not acting on it.
Well, at low Earth orbit, the gravity difference between what you and I are feeling and what the International Space Station is feeling is almost nothing. It's hard to tell the difference. But when you start getting 35, well, remember, it's so many radii. The planet Earth is only 6,000 kilometers in radius. So you're talking multiple radii of the planet Earth, five or six of them. So, six radii of the planet Earth from the center. Gravity would be remarkably decreased up there. Well, the force of gravity would be
decreased. So you'd expect something really high up to be going even faster than the ISS, but because the gravity's weaker, it doesn't have to go that fast.
Yeah, that's probably true too. Yes, you're right. It doesn't have to. Exactly right. Yes. So I didn't take into account gravity before. Yeah, that makes sense. There you go. It's really interesting. Orbital mechanics is really fascinating. And where I learned, and I've learned a lot of the stuff and read about it and formula and that sort of stuff. Honestly, I would highly recommend people play with it is Kerbal Space Program.
I knew you were going to say Kerbal.
Kerbal's amazing. I mean, it's not perfect. It doesn't do everything right, and it's a silly game. But I grokked launching. When I built my first rocket and put it into orbit around the Earth in Kerbal successfully and parked it in an orbit, a low Earth orbit, I went, oh. All the stuff I'd learned over the years, I went, oh, this all makes perfect sense now, why you have to do this. And I had to then dock a spaceship and grab another spaceship, like a Kerbal was stuck in space, and he was in a higher orbit, and that talking about accelerating to go higher and decelerating to go lower. And if you want to go – if you want to wait, get someone to catch up with you, then you slow down a bit and you drop down, and that means they're going faster than you, and if they go overshoot you, then you speed up again, catch up, but you lower down. So it's kind of, you work out, it's impressive. So look at Kerbal Space Program. It's free, and Kerbal Space Program 2 is about to come out, which will be hopefully even better, because they've had a long time to make this one good.
Yeah. No, I've heard good things about it.
It's fun. It's super fun. And there's very clever people. The one I would highly recommend watching is Scott Manley. He's a Scottish guy. He's an engineer, and he plays Kerbal all the time, and he does tutorials on how to do it all. Highly recommend it. Anyway, so Al, there's your answer. I hope that helps you out.
Those will be in the show notes.
Yes,
all be in the show notes. Get onto smartenough.org and the show notes to Kerbal and the Let's Play.
Yes, that's exactly right. And if you have a question that I can butcher for you, feel free to get in contact, and I'm happy to have a crack at it. Sasquatch and Bigfoot, who is who?
Welcome to the Walk of Shame.
To the Walk of Shame.
What did you call it before?
I can't remember. I couldn't remember.
Welcome to a new segment on the podcast called We F***ed Up. Episode of We F***ed Up, Greg, has any listener written in to tell us that we f***ed up?
I don't want to call it that.
All right, it's back to the Walk of Shame then.
Welcome to the Walk of Shame, where you, the audience, tell us where we f***ed up.
So, Greg, where did I f*** up?
Oh, Dan, we haven't got time, Dan. We haven't got time.
Right. We've got a whole segment for it, Greg.
All right, let's do it properly.
Oh, no, this is the podcast, baby.
Oh, God damn it. Well, Dan, Al Batson, who we talked about before, he did point out that he said that
he's going to be responsible for like 60% of the content of this episode.
Fantastic. Al said in episode 162 at 39 minutes and 38 seconds. Well done. Dan says that badgers prefer to mate during the full moon as the darkness provides protection from predators. I suspect he means not on the full moon.
Oh, yeah.
And then he yells, then he writes, science, in all in caps.
Yeah, thank you for that science. Damn it.
Thanks, Al.
Okay, so Al Batson told me last episode,
and, hi, Al.
And you backed him up, that male/female is determined by how the chromosomes express themselves. I said someone with Slayer syndrome who has XY chromosomes but the Y doesn't express itself was still male at a genetic level.
Right.
Okay, so Wikipedia stated it is also possible in a variety of species, including humans, to be XXY or have other intersex hermaphroditic qualities, though one would still be considered genotypically male as long as one has the Y chromosome. So that backs it up.
Right.
But it also points out it's genotypically, but not necessarily phenotypically.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
So the issue comes down to genotypically or phenotypically. You could have a human that is genotypically male, but phenotypically female, or vice versa with Syndrome de la Chapelle.
So phenotypically means looks like or presents as, where genotypically means genetically is. Is that what it means?
Phenotypically means formed as.
Formed as. Okay, good. Right. Thank you. Makes sense.
Genotypically is the instructions.
Got it. Okay.
So the instructions didn't work and it did something else.
Sure.
Okay. So there's a thing called Syndrome de la Chapelle. It's where you can be genetically female, but phenotypically male. So you can have it go both ways.
Okay.
So phenotypically, you could express various combinations of penis, vagina, mix of both, or neither. Not only could these combinations of sexual expression occur between the legs, but also in the brain. Hormones are behind all of this. And this is just sex.
Yeah.
The physical process of a singular human creature mutating to allow for horizontal genetic transfer. The whole thing is a hack, Greg.
Yeah.
No wonder it only sometimes works. It is a very natural and deep-seated instinct to judge whether other people are breed with or not so much breed with individuals. It's a deep-seated instinct driven by our DNA to copy itself, to be selfish. But the practical upshot of this is if someone says their gender is something that doesn't match what you've naturally assumed, have some damned humility. You've almost definitely been wrong making this instinctual judgment in the past. And unless you've done scientific tests on your own carrier type, you could even be wrong about yourself.
Yeah.
But that doesn't matter Because no matter what that test were to return, you know what gender you are. It's obvious to you.
That's very good. Thank you. I like that. That's very cool. I think what I'm going to learn most about this is complicated and confusing, and just be cool. Everyone be cool. Everyone just be cool.
It's like the opposite of a binary thing.
Yeah. That's right.
It's digital. No, it's not digital. It's analog. It's fucking analog.
We are human beings, analog as fuck. There we go.
We're analog as fuck. That's going to be the new Smart Enough t-shirt.
I was about to say that. We should have that made. Human beings, analog as fuck. That'd be awesome. Thank you. That was great. That's very good. It's so confusing. Biology is crazy. Like, I just, thank God I do physics. Nice, easy, simple physics.
Jump cut to crashing yet another Kerbal spacecraft.
Very true. Now, this one came from multiple people, but Eloise managed to beat Michael Barnes by seconds. Literal seconds, I like to point out. So Eloise very nicely sent me an email, but she said, I'm sure that Michael Barnes has already commented on this. And then, honestly, within a minute, I got an email from Michael Barnes going, let me tell you. And I was like, Eloise, no, you beat her to the punch. So this is for Eloise first, but Michael said the same thing. Dan, you said in the past that Komodo dragons kill by biting something, and their mouth bacteria kills the animal over time. So they bite them, and the animal runs off, and the bacteria infects the wound.
That was disproven, wasn't it?
This has been disproven, exactly right.
When did I say this then?
You said it in a podcast.
But obviously a really recent one, because two people picked me up on it. I know this. How did I bugger this up?
Well, I
bet it was a joke. I was using it as a point of reference.
Well, there you go. Associate Professor Brian Flight.
I'm going to be less funny. I'm going to be less funny from this point on.
Be like, no, that's my job, Dan. You're the funny one. I'm the one who makes all the walks of shame possible.
It's a delicate balance.
So, obviously, you do know that Komodo dragons, our mouths are not very dirty. In fact, they're venomous animals. They actually do inject venom, so they can actually bring down with their venom. And as Professor Brian Fry from the Biological Sciences at the University of Queensland points out, nature is not about animals being cool, like biting and letting your friend eat the animal that when it dies nearby them, like 2 days later from an infected wound. Rubbish. It doesn't happen. So these animals do try very hard to kill their prey, and sometimes they get away, and then another animal will bring them down, but another Komodo dragon will bring them down. But no, they're venomous creatures, and they're very large, and they don't hunt with dirty mouth bacteria. But you already knew that, so still going to walk.
God damn it. Fair enough. Okay, here's a fun one.
Yes.
Scott Driscoll wrote in, you mentioned that if the Ewoks on Endor were under a micromoon, they'd be Ewoks, but under a supermoon, they'd be Wookiees. Lovely flight of fancy there. That's quite fun.
We're talking about werewolf kind of things. So werewolf they explode stuff. Out. Yeah, okay, right.
If the full moon's really far away, it was you'd a turn joke. Into a little tiny wolf. If the full moon's really close, you turn into a really big one.
It's not a far away. It's supermoon doesn't get that much closer. But anyway,
no, but we're crossing our T's and dotting our I's.
We are.
It's funny how did we fuck up has really put us on the back foot.
It's true.
Scott says the Ewoks lived on the moon of Endor. Endor was the planet. So they wouldn't have been on Endor under a micromoon or a supermoon. They lived on the moon that orbits the planet Endor.
Are we sure of that? Because it's called the moon of Endor. That could mean two things. It could be the moon called Endor, or it could be the planet Endor that has a moon.
Every time someone sends in one of these Walk of Shames, I go and I double check this stuff.
Thank you, darling.
So they lived on the moon that orbits the planet.
Right.
So they are always the same distance from the moon of Endor when it is full. They're on the moon of Endor.
Yes.
So there's always the same distance. They're standing on it.
Right. Yes.
And when it's full, i.e. the middle of the day, on the moon of Endor.
Okay.
Because they're basically orbiting at ground level above this moon.
Right.
Now, of course, the planet of Endor would hang in the sky over them.
Yeah, it'd be huge. When it was it in the movie? Was there a planet there to look at? Okay. So there was a moon. Hang on a minute. Sorry. Just jumping sideways here. Yeah. Recently, I read an article saying that they've just recently named a moon that goes around a moon.
A moon moon.
Yeah, the moon moon. So the Death Star 2 was a moon moon of the moon of Endor.
Only if it was orbiting Endor. And I don't know whether it was. It wasn't, because it was orbiting... But it wasn't. It was orbiting the planet and trying to get close enough so that the moon was in view.
No. We're talking about rebuilding the Death Star. It had to be. It was floating above because they were firing up the energy to keep the shields to stop the rebel fleet.
Yeah, I'm thinking of something else, aren't I?
It must have been geostationary or lunostationary orbit around the moon of Endor, which was in orbit around the planet of Endor.
Yeah.
So confusing. So the moon of Endor has no name. It's just the moon.
So you came up and it's like, that's no moon moon.
It's the moon moon.
That's a space destroyer, space station. Okay.
When he said that's no moon, that was when it was around a planet. That was the first one. But when it's around, when they're rebuilding in Return of the Jedi, that's no moon moon. That's when he had to change it. He's dead at that point. But he could have said it's a moon the first time. It's an artificial moon. And then it gets blown up. And in Return of the Jedi, the new one is a moon moon. It's a moon moon of the moon of Endor.
Well, it's not a moon moon.
It's not a moon moon
That's
of the moon
no
of Endor.
No moon moon.
That's right. Okay. We should write the next. We'd be so good. Get a YK.
No. The writers of Star Wars, they're pretty tight. They run a pretty tight ship. Okay. the planet of Endor would hang in the sky over the Ewoks. When it is full, perhaps this instigates the changes. But this isn't really a lunar event. I guess you would call it a Terran event. Okay, but...
If the planet, a planetary event, yeah. Anyway, yeah.
But there are eight other moons around the planet Endor. Right. There's Alpretzar, Fentaka, Ghouls, Hualmaka, Kefbir, Korkar, Shafts, and Vix. And any one of them could be full from the point of view of the Ewok home.
What's the one the Ewoks are standing on?
Ah, you want to know the name of the moon of Endor. Okay.
Not just all them, yes.
Okay, well, if we're still thinking about the other moons, the difference between a micromoon and a supermoon for those moons is going to be quite different.
Adding
legs to your theory that it could change between a little tiny one and a great big furry one.
I'm confused. I'm assuming the audience have no idea what's going on right now.
Well, because the moons are all orbiting at a different rate. And so sometimes when they're full, they're going to be really close to the moon of Endor, and sometimes they're going to be really far away.
I just want to know the name of the moon of Endor. I want to know its name. Oh, yeah. You just named other ones. You've named other moons
all
of
right.
Endor.
All right. Well, I'll get there. The only thing that really screws you up on this Walk of Shame, because everything else is panning out for you.
Oh, good. Thank you.
I'm trying to stay in your corner here.
Oh, I appreciate that.
I'm trying to prove Scott Driscoll wrong.
Good, good.
Okay.
Always good to yell at people.
The only thing is, you literally did say that they were standing on Endor when this happens, rather than on the moon of Endor, the forest moon of Endor, sanctuary moon.
Right.
Now, Endor is a gas giant, so you can't stand on it unless you were not very dense at all.
No, okay. Like a force ghost.
You could have also used the official name of the moon.
Oh, thank God. Here we go. That's what I want.
Let me just look that up.
Yep.
It's Endor. Endor the moon orbits Endor the planet. So it is both the forest moon of Endor and the forest moon of Endor. Endor orbits Endor. Greg, guess what system this planetary bodies reside in?
Is it Endor?
Bing, 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 bing. The Endor system is a binary system, and you'll never guess what one of the suns is called.
Is it Endor?
Very close. It's Endor 2.
So there's Endor 1 and Endor 2.
That is correct. You've guessed the name of the other sun. Well done.
Wait. In the Endor system, there's Endor 1 and Endor 2. Endor 2 has a planet called Endor, which is surrounded by multiple moons, one of which is called Endor.
Wait, you're almost right. It's the Endor system. Endor and Endor orbit each other whilst being orbited themselves by Endor, that 2 is orbited by Endor. A very rare piece of lazy writing in the Star Wars nonology. So you don't have to walk any walks of shame.
Oh, my.
Someone does. Yeah. Someone
George
does.
George Lucas.
Holy shitballs.
All right. Michael Barnes did write about Komodo dragons, but he's not just relying on Komodo dragons. In the last episode, at 14 minutes and 50 seconds, you, Dan, called Jonathan Frakes' role in Star Trek as number two when his sobriquet was number one.
Oh.
So you had the captain and number one. He wasn't number two. The captain wasn't number one.
So Picard's zero.
Yes, he is Agent Zero.
Ah, oh, you know what? There was a webcomic like 20 years ago called Sev Trek, where I think that they called him number two, and it was lots of poo jokes.
It's a poo joke. There you go. Yeah. Also in Bond, because we probably listen to that podcast, there's number one, number two, number three, number four, number five. So maybe you're getting from there too. Then one for you, Dan, from the planet Dan, surrounded by Dan, in orbit in the system of Dan. Dan brings up an interesting point. He thought you'd got something wrong when you talked about social distancing. Of course, all the interesting stuff in the world going on right now, people staying apart from each other so we don't catch each other's filthy disease. And he thought it was really weird when you said, hey, everyone, stay 1.5 meters away. And he went, aha, I've caught Dan out. Because it's 2 meters. He knew it was 2 meters. So he looked up, he checked online, and he went, yep, it's 2 meters. Yes, I'm right. But when he did some more research, he realized that Australia, actually, our government does say 1.5 meters. So he couldn't really get you. But now he's angry, because now he's saying that, well, all this research says it should be 2 meters away. And so why is Australia? He wants Australia to go on a walk of shame. So the walk of shame is for the Australian government.
Different thing, different measurement thing.
Because seriously...
Because it's really an Australian meter as compared to a Canadian meter or something.
Maybe, yes. So basically he's angry. He wants Australia to take a walk of shame because he says, you're not even reading your own research when picking a social distancing range. It's not like you guys are short on space. So
yeah, that's
I looked into this, and he seems to be correct in one way, in the fact that in the UK, social distancing by the government said 2 meters. So they said 2 meters. And in Australia... the health organization, so health.gov.au, said 1.5 meters. In America, it's 6 feet. And 6 feet is roughly 1.8 meters, 1.83 or whatever it is. So every country had a different distance. And I think it's just – I honestly think that distance just means stay away as far as you can go and think about it.
Maybe they have wider supermarket aisles where they're from. Because maybe, if you walk down our supermarket aisles and you have to stay 2 meters away from someone, they're just one-way aisles.
You couldn't,
You couldn't get past.
And some supermarkets have done that, by the way, where you can only go up one aisle and down another aisle. Like they put little arrows.
That's clever.
They've tried very hard. So I don't know if it's a walk of shame. I see what Dan's saying. It's just different countries said differently. In our country, I saw them saying, hey, stay one gray kangaroo apart. That's roughly the right – 1.5 meters is roughly the length of a gray kangaroo, which we all are very, very aware of.
I mean, you have to be pretty close to one of them to really – it's like stop signs. Like if you stop signs, you're like, oh, what is it, 40 centimeters across? But then you like unbolt one and pull it down and then run home with it and the cover of darkness. You're like, this is fucking enormous.
That's right. Well, we may have talked about this before on the podcast. How long is that line in the center of the road on a normal suburban street? And you're like, it's like a meter long. No, it's not. It's as long as your car. They're huge.
Yeah.
They're really, really big. It's just because you're driving on them really quickly, you'd think they're shorter.
Yeah.
Or you're going so fast that Lorentz transformations have kicked in and you're getting close to the speed of light and it's actually getting shorter.
It's like real red at the beginning and real blue at the back.
Something like that. So I don't know. I see what he said. Well, I also saw that a llama had one llama distance between you and someone else. So I guess what Dan is saying is technically correct for Australia, but I don't know. I just think that different countries...
Whoever's making the rules in Australia is dropping the ball all over the spot. They need to have a good, hard look at themselves.
There you go. Dan's calling out the government. Thanks. So thank you, Dan, who named Colin, for calling out Dan, for calling out the Australian government. God, it's Endo all over again. It's ridiculous.
If you hear Greg say something wrong, please send an email to dan@smartenough.org.
And if Dan happens to make a mistake, get in contact at greg@smartenough.org.
You have been listening to Dan at smartenough.org.
We just said this, and I'm Greg at smartenough.org.
Yeah, but I put a little thing between it. And really know the address.
Okay, excellent.
If you would like to follow us, subscribe to us, respond on our website, basically anything you want to do with this podcast at this point, the interactive part, happens at smartenough.org.
Yeah,
jump over there, press the buttons you want to press.
Yeah. Occasionally I put things on Facebook, not as much anymore, to be honest. I don't want to. And of course,
We don't even ask you to put in reviews and rate on iTunes anymore because, I don't know.
No, it's all a thing. So, of course, Twitter, we're quite active on Twitter. So at SE2KB is also a good place to find us. We're probably more likely to respond very quickly. And we actually love hearing from you. So whatever you want to talk about, get in contact with us. We're happy to chat.
And we both watch that account. And we also have personal accounts if you're really interested in following your nonsense.
That's right. You're worth all that out. So it's the internet. You can just type us in. If you type in Greg Wire, you're going to find it. If you type in Dan Beeson, you're going to find it. It's pretty simple.
Greg, this is a bit of an exciting moment.
Oh.
Right now?
What's that?
Because we're winding up this episode.
Yes.
And this is the end of 10 years of Smart Enough to
Know
Better.
Is it really? Holy moly.
163 episodes, 51 bonus episodes, 212 hours of content.
Wow.
That would take Al Batson or Steve Stewart almost 2 weeks to get to his... it's 8.8 days of content.
Nice.
Straight.
That's all, every one of them, champagne.
If we consider that every episode takes about 10 man hours, which is an underestimation.
That's true. Yeah.
Considering a 40 hour...
Let's go human hours. Why not? Let's go crazy.
Considering a 40 hour work week, that's 53 working weeks of effort or just over a year.
Working non... Wow. That's incredible. Goodness me.
120 months, Greg, and not a single month missed.
Wow. We haven't either. Yeah, you're right.
There have been...
It came close. It came close sometimes.
Look, sometimes it came out a couple of days after the month, but there was definitely a podcast for every month.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Statistically, we're fine.
There have been 357 162 downloads from the site. Mm. That's 14,742 days of podcast listened to.
Wow.
Do you know what that means, Gregoire?
What's that?
You know what that means?
What's that?
Means our beloved listeners aren't spreading the news effectively. That's less than 2,000 downloads per episode. What the f***, guys? I thought you wanted to support us. Get off your duff and start fucking evangelizing. I mean, Christ, David Tennant can get those sort of numbers in a week.
It's true. It's true. He's very handsome, though.
They don't know how handsome we're not.
It'd be nice if more people heard us. I would like that. I would like that. We have been around for a long time, and we're fun, and we're sexy.
And not usually this belligerent.
Yes, we are.
Oh, that's
Shut
true.
Up. Shut up. Yes, we are.
That's what they tune in for. Okay, if you want to alleviate the guilt that you're feeling, the lashings of guilt, you could subscribe to our Patreon account.
Yeah.
And donate some money every month.
Or, of course, on our website, we have the tip jar.
Yes, there's the tip jar. If you don't like Patreon or don't like signing up for something, you just drop a bit of cash in.
Yeah.
Some people are happier doing that. And some people have had to drift away at this, difficult time.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And, we thank them for the money that they have been able to spend on us. We're not going to sit here and complain about them losing, not to them, but to you guys. Like, up your game.
That's right. Get it out. Get us out there. Let us all go. Right. People go.
So
people kind of go, why would you listen to them? It's just two guys chatting. But what two guys?
Dreamy. And what problematic content.
Oh, my goodness. You never know how close we're going to skirt to good taste. Because we sure as hell don't. That's the fun thing about improvising. You just don't know. You know those American Lives and 99% Invisible? They spend hours and hours and days crafting sentences and putting them all together. It's perfect. And we as improvisers just seat of our pants, fly through. And sometimes we mention Nazis a lot. It happens. But that's what makes us special, Dan.
Nazis are a thing that happened. Like,
did.
I'm not trying to erase them from history. We need to be able to look upon our Nazi statues to remember the horrors that happened.
What are we talking about?
The Nazi flag is flown proudly so that I know that will never happen again.
That's not a thing, everyone. That's not a thing.
No, sorry, that's not a Nazi flag. That's the American Civil War flag. So that's
Stop speaking.
But I still have to thank people for signing up to our Patreon.
You do. Okay,
so I would like to thank Matthew Toy, Lindsay Jenkinson, Elizabeth Youngkin, A.V. Greenbury, Andrew Whitehurst, Andrew Trousdale, Phil Holland, Michael Barnes, Gary Heather, Steve E. The next person I have to thank, I called her Grainy Maguire last time.
Yes.
And she went, all right, I've had my fun. Now I'm going to send an email about how to say it properly with phonetic spelling and I thought this was going above and beyond, a link to a YouTube video with someone who has the exact same name as her introducing herself.
Right.
Which I thought was pretty swish. So I will be intentionally getting it wrong this time just because I'm a jerk. So thank you very much to Granny Maguire.
Don't!
She sounds like a good witch, if you call her that.
But that isn't... Oh, Dan. Was that Gron?
Grawny. Grawny. I just call her Granny.
Gron. Okay, all right.
Don't. It makes it sound like she's going to make me soup.
And are you sure it's a woman?
Well, the woman who introduced herself as Grawny Maguire was.
Excellent. Okay, good. Okay, fair enough. Cool.
But as we've worked out from the Walk of Shame, I'm not capable of making effective assumptions.
Is she surrounded by the forest moon of Grawny and makes an assistant of Grawny? But look, thank you very much. We're making a butchery of your name because we're horrible Anglophiles. We apologize for that.
Thank you very much, Grawny Maguire.
Yeah, we do appreciate it.
Also to Morden O'Hare, Alana Mitchell, and Matt Ewers.
Yay!
Now, if you're at the top tier, then you get to be insulted by me.
This is still a thing.
It is. It's more popular than it's ever been, Greg.
Oh, great. Good.
Okay. So, autumn is here in the Southern Hemisphere.
And I like to call it the proper hemisphere.
So that will be the thrust of these insults.
Good, good.
Now, first and foremost, Al Batson and Eric Wilson are at this tier, but they say I don't have to insult them, and they are the evergreen perennials of Smart Enough to Know Better. Okay, Steve Stewart. Steve, it's time to make like a tree and leave, 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 leave.
Wow.
It's autumn, you know.
No, I got it. Yeah. Okay. Wow, you really doubled down on that.
Yeah. Tom Seary. It's time to make like a leaf and drop dead.
Okay. Good.
Dustin Fallon, it's a time of stagnation and decay. So no need to update the resume. Mitchell Keating, speaking of people and difficult to pronounce names and people doing the right thing, by sending me useful information about how to pronounce it, and Mikkel Keita, who delighted in the fact that we mispronounced his name three different ways in the first episode and has absolutely resolved not to fix that since then.
Good, good. Make you work for it.
So Mitchell Keita lives in the Northern Hemisphere, and yet the nights still seem to be getting longer for those around him. Oh, and finally, Scott Driscoll. Now, don't tell him, but if things go sideways, Greg, he's our fall guy. Thank you very much to all of the people donating. And thank you very much to the people who don't give us enough money to have their names read out. We love you too. Now, our next episode is our 10th birthday episode, I guess.
Yeah.
But there was some discussion about having a live event. Weirdly enough, off the cards these days.
Yeah, it's been... We can make up for it. How about we don't make it the 10-year anniversary? We'll just call it the 9-point-something anniversary. We'll have a 10-year anniversary when the world's not so insane.
Oh, no, we'll figure it out. We might do something fun for next episode. We might just do a normal episode. You should be following us on Twitter.
Yeah.
Because that's that's where you're going to find out about it.
I'd like to have another meetup, actually. Would people like a Zoom meetup again? I think I'd like one. That'd be fun. I had fun last time. Let's have another one. We'll do something. We'll do something. Yep. If you have an idea for the 10-year anniversary, what you'd like to see us do, let us know. Keep it reasonable. Like, you know, fly to the moon and give me some rocks. Like, that's not going to happen.
It doesn't even matter. I'm going to ignore all of them. So make it as wild as you want.
But anyway, if you've got some good ideas, let us know. We'd love to know. It'd be really fun.
And as we always like to say...
Endor.
That's if John Malkovich goes into Endor's head. Okay, so as we dig down, it's getting hotter and hotter. But why?
Mm-hmm.
Now, this all started because a couple of months ago, Dr. Carl Krasinski, very mm-hmm. popular radio mm. broadcasting science communicator,
mm.
tweeted that it was due to But I want you to answer.
Okay.
When I all say, right. but why, I'm like...
All right. So, okay, well, so fine. We dig down. Okay. Ask the question.